Sip Podcast. Wanna know what's happening to Steve? Sip Podcast. Don't you know it's Grierson and Leach? Grierson and Leach. Grierson and Leach. Don't you know it's Grierson and Leach?
Hi, I'm Tim Grierson.
And hi, I'm Will Leach, and this is the Grierson and Leach Podcast. Episode 175. Grierson, we have a lot of movies to get to this week, so we're going to cut down with the chit-chat. I know generally people, their favorite part of this podcast is when we ramble on for the first 5 minutes.
Yes, I can imagine. I'm sure you get tons of emails to griersonleach@gmail.com where people say, could you chit-chat more before the movies, you know, the stuff that we're actually here to listen to?
Yeah, could you guys just go off on a rambling little detour or side street about something that happened specifically to you guys in like 1992 that we don't care about at all? It is only a couple of in-jokes between the two of you. Please keep going down that cul-de-sac for a good 9 to 10 minutes.
Yeah. Is there anything that made Will really mad this week that he wants to vent about? Can we hear about it?
I feel like I have been venting a lot lately. I don't mean to vent so much lately. I don't know.
Well, we are in your favorite season, as it's been well documented.
Summer! What's with all this outside and sun and sand? You know what, Chris? And I hate sand. I hate sand. It just gets everywhere.
Yeah, sand is fine to hate. Your disdain for summer, I don't want to get into it. Because we have a lot of movies to talk about, but I always enjoy now when summer starts, as I think, oh, my good friend and colleague, he hates this season so much.
It just goes on forever. It's global warming. I don't know if my friend, for the record, last thing, my editor at New York Magazine, my longtime editor at New York Magazine, is David Wallace Wells, who wrote the great book, The Uninhabitable Earth, which is all over the place right now. And if you read it, it will terrify you about how we're all going to die very, very soon because of the environment. You know what book I'm talking about, Grierson, right?
Yes. And I don't want to be even more terrified than I normally am.
It's a very well-researched, very smart, very good book. He's an engaging writer, but he has been my editor at New York Magazine, my columns, both the magazine on the web, not the Vulture stuff. We have a different editor for that. But for my personal stuff about sports and the like, he has been my editor for years and years and years. And I have to tell you, it is becoming increasingly difficult to write about silly sports things and file them to the guy that wrote a book called The Uninhabitable Earth. I'm just letting you know, it's every once in a while. Like, he actually wrote me, had an edit back to me one time and said, I don't know, Will, this is a little dark, isn't it? I was like, what? I'm writing about the Knicks.
That, to be fair, the entire destruction of our planet and the Knicks.
Yeah, same shit.
Pretty comparable.
Same shit. This is the Grierson-Leach Podcast, episode 175. Follow us on Twitter at GriersonLeach. We're also on Facebook, kind of, Instagram a little. Email us, griersonleach@gmail.com. Go to our website, griersonleach.com. Go to our griersonleach.com/RSVP. See a list of every single movie we talked about on our entire podcast. The opening song is from Dylan Mayer. On Cuthbert Avenue is the album. You can find it on Bandcamp and SoundCloud. Closing song is My Friend Mary. The short song is A Melancholy Longings. Facebook page, My Friend Mary Grierson. I believe we sell a t-shirt.
We do. It's available at cottonbureau.com.
Cottonbureau.com. I know we haven't sold one of those in like a couple of weeks. Because
do people not want to get porked?
I know. I haven't sold one a couple weeks because I got an email, like an automated email from Cotton Bureau saying, sounds like you haven't sold any shirts in a couple of weeks. Would you like to be part of our promotion plan? I was like, first off, no. Secondly, don't be a dick, Cotton Bureau. Okay, come on.
Well, why are they? Yeah, they're like dunking on us.
I know.
That's
come
not
on.
Nice.
We do one show a week. We mention it. You know why? You know everything else we're getting. We're getting tons of hits on Twitter. Probably. I don't know. Facebook. Yeah, maybe. Who cares? Instagram. Yeah, I don't know. But CottonBureau.com. No buys. You know why? Because Grierson's doing the ad for that one. Grierson, you're not selling hard enough. Always be closing.
I mentioned I was wearing it a couple weeks ago. You thought that would have just driven sales.
Okay, now
apparently
I understand.
Not.
Now I know what happened. Anyway, so you should subscribe to us, however, after you don't buy the t-shirt, apparently. Subscribe to us on Google Play, Stitcher, Overcast, SoundCloud, Spotify, iHeartRadio. But the best way still to get the podcast is subscribe to us on iTunes/Apple Podcasts. And if you do, leave us the name of a movie you would like us to discuss, and we will discuss it in our reboot section when we have time for a reboot. We have 4 new movies this week, so there's no time for such a reboot. And Grierson, honestly, I'm still, we are taping this on Saturday afternoon. I have been, I'm not in St. Louis for the St. Louis Blues Championship Parade. Go Blues. Woo! Go Blues. Go Blues. Made John Hamm very happy. So, you know, there's a lot.
He's there right now. You're not there.
There's a lot. I'm not there either. I know. He's a better fan.
John Hamm's there.
It's worth noting that
John Hamm is less busy than we are, clearly.
You know, my favorite John Hamm thing about the Blues is that apparently, you know, he had his playoff beard, which is a big thing in hockey. People grow playoff beards. Greer said, I can't grow beards, but if we could.
I was going to say, how is our beard going? Yeah. As well as our t-shirt sales, I'd say.
Yes. I'm barely a mammal. Anyway, but John Hamm shaved his beard. They made him shave his beard for Top Gun 2. And so he shaved his beard right before game 6. And so they got killed in game 6. And so there was the curse of John Hamm's beard. And he'd shaved his playoff beard. And everyone was really mad at Tom Cruise again. It was his fault. It's always Tom Cruise's fault somehow. But turns out the Blues won the Stanley Cup. We don't have to blame John Hamm or Tom Cruise. Anyway, we have 4 movies to talk about this week. So are you ready? Are you strapped in, Grishin? Are you excited? We got 4 big ones to talk about.
I'm glad that this was our episode where we didn't do as much chit chat.
It's only like 6 minutes in. That's not so bad.
It's not too bad. It's not too bad for us. We have 4 new movies, and I have bad news for everybody. Will seen them all. So our
I know,
fun segment of just me with the listeners will not happen. We have seen all 4 of these. So we'll be discussing all 4 of them together.
I was less lazy this week. I actually went out and bothered to see them. Usually I'm just like, yeah, Grierson watches. He does like that movie, watches movies all the time. Why do I need to bother? This week, I brought my A game. So we go to our first new movie of the week, and our first new movie is Men in Black International.
It took me 20 years to find you. How many people can say that? You are the best kept secret in the universe. And I found you.
Which makes me perfect for this job.
You really think a black suit is going to solve all your problems?
No, but looks damn good on you. Oh, snap! Oh,
snap! Men in Black : International is the 4th film in the series. And if you're thinking, Will Smith and Tommy Lee Jones, I love these movies. I have bad news for you. They are not in this one.
They are briefly in a painting.
They are briefly in a painting, but I don't think they get residuals for that. Yeah. Wait, did you notice the painting? Because they didn't hold on it long enough so that everybody could go, hey, those are the actors we like in these movies. This is the first one also not directed by Barry Sonnenfeld. It is, in fact, directed by F. Gary Gray. This movie stars Tessa Thompson as the newest member of the Men in Black, who, since her childhood, when she was reading Stephen Hawking books, apparently, has always wanted to be part of the Men in Black when she discovered that such an organization existed, because like all good proactive female characters in Hollywood blockbusters now, she loves science. So as an adult, played by Tessa Thompson, her name is Molly, she goes to the Men in Black, talks her way into a probationary position at the Men in Black. She is named Agent M, because her first name is Molly, and she is assigned to the London branch. Did you know, Will, that it wasn't just in New York? It is, in fact, international. It is a whole thing that they do. And she is paired up with Chris Hemsworth's character, Agent H, who is responsible for one of the great global saving missions from years ago when he worked with Agent High T, played by Liam Neeson. Why does he have a high in front of his name? No one seems to know the answer to this, by the way. I've done some research. Nobody knows. But Agent M and Agent H are teamed up, and they are supposed to meet up with a friendly alien who is coming to Earth. Spoiler alert, that mission goes very badly, very tragically, and they have to hunt down, or actually protect, a jewel that the alien leaves with Agent M, and this alien is coming to hunt them down. Actually, it's twins. I was told, I was not aware of this, since I have yet to see Beyonce's Homecoming concert film on Netflix. These twins are actually dancers in that film. They are not dancing, except for one scene in this movie, but they are trying to kill Agent H and Agent M, who are
and
to
twins! Sorry, I just had to do the chorus line commercial. Sorry. I just
plot,
said, I heard
plot description, that's as fine a way to the plot description of
that's
this. So I really loved Men in Black, as Will mentioned last week. I was a big fan of it. It was in my top 10 of 1997. I thought it was such a fun, a perfect vehicle for Will Smith, who is paired perfectly with Tommy Lee Jones in that movie. Also, that movie is like 93 minutes long. Remember when summer movies were 93 minutes long? Men in Black 2 was absolutely atrocious, and they kind of reversed their fortunes with Men in Black 3, which I thought was very fun, especially with Josh Brolin playing a young Tommy Lee Jones and doing an awesome Tommy Lee Jones impression in the movie. It was fun. It was substantial enough. I enjoyed it. That was 7 years ago, Men in Black 3, I believe. Men in Black International is absolutely atrocious. It is absolutely, absolutely terrible. And it's weird because Chris Hemsworth and Tessa Thompson were previously in Thor Ragnarok together, where they're nothing less than delightful. They're so fun in that movie. I think a lot of people thought, hey, pair them up together. And Kumail Nanjiani, everybody loves him. He was so great in The Big Sick. He'll do the voice of this like small alien character who hangs out with them. That could be fun. Hey, Rebecca Ferguson, she's great in those Mission Impossible movies. She'll play a multi-armed arms dealer. Get it? She'll be fun. What could go wrong with this movie? It is, I reviewed this for Screen International, and one of the things I mentioned in my review is that this movie is stunningly inert. There are maybe, say, 4 or 5 laughs in this thing, but what is sort of most apparent in Men in Black International is that this is a film that feels like it was made because Sony needed it to be made. It feels very much like Girl Kicking the Spider's Web or whatever the hell that movie was from last year, which is also a Sony project. They own these bits of intellectual property. They feel like they have to keep them around so audiences stay interested in them. But Men in Black International has none of the fun. It has none of the novelty. It has none of the fun, just like camaraderie of the first film, especially. At this point, seeing like quirky aliens and seeing moderately interesting sci-fi action sequences is just not sufficient. This movie is almost 2 hours long. It goes on forever. I absolutely hated this movie.
It's not good. I don't think I hate it quite as much as you, but yeah, it's not good. I feel like there was an idea here somewhere. And I feel like after the first kind of dull sequence with Chris Hemsworth and Liam Neeson, when we meet young Tessa Thompson's character and we realize that kind of her history with the Men in Black, and we see that she's into science and she's kind of interesting and she's smart and kind of driven, and she runs into Emma Thompson, I thought, okay, are like, I could get into this. This is really what you want to do with a movie like this. You take a sort of existing brand, you kind of update a little bit, make it a little bit more diverse, a little bit more interesting, and you both kind of undercut the original material while still having enough kind of nostalgic reverence for it that you can kind of keep the ball rolling and update a little bit. But then the movie just stops. And I really can't kind of put much more than that. It feels like the movie stops happening. And you call it inert. And it really just feels like, it just kind of feels like the movie starts to get going and then like gets a little stuck in a ditch and then spins its wheels for a while and then just kind of stops. And then the movie just kind of slowly rolls out after that. It's weird. It's this weird combination of frantic and sleepy, if that makes sense. It feels like it's like pedaling really hard to get the energy of the first film, and maybe the third film. But there's no it feels like fake pedaling. It's fake hustle, as they would call it in sports. There's something about it that feels like they are trying to impersonate and revive a franchise, but don't actually really care about it. And to be honest, I know you. I like the first movie. I don't like it as much as you do. And I really was not really. Everyone agrees the second one was bad. And the third one I thought was just kind of boring. It's weird because, you know, there are times this movie, like the painting that I've referred to, that wants to like hint at like a larger universe, larger Men in Black kind of universe. But I don't think this series is interesting enough, at least outside of the first film, to be able to justify that. I mean, maybe I'm wrong, Grierson. I'm sure the internet is a big place. I'm sure there are Men in Black obsessives. There are people out there that are release the Sonnenfeld cut of something out there. Just total lunatics out there. Maybe they're out there. I've never met them. I probably don't want to meet them if they do exist. But it doesn't seem to me anyway that Men in Black is just this deeply beloved franchise that people are like, oh, yes, 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 finally. Finally, we're going to get Men in Black back on track. We want it back so badly. It feels like, you talk about, it feels like a brand, a company basically dealing, trying to revive a mostly dormant asset. And that's a bummer. It's particularly a bummer because, as you talked about, Tessa Thompson and Chris Hemsworth were good in Thor Ragnarok. They were very good in that movie together. And she is at least a little game in this. And I kind of, you can at least follow what's going on with her. Hemsworth is actually pretty bad in this. I'm sad to say. We all like Chris Hemsworth. We particularly like this turn that he's kind of made toward comedy recently. There's no character here. This performance reminded me a little bit of when Chris Pratt is trying too hard to do like a Harrison Ford kind of tough rebel guy, and I'm cocky and all the women love me, and I just didn't buy it, which I would expect to buy more from Chris Hemsworth than Chris Pratt. That doesn't really work. Liam Neeson barely seems to be awake in this movie. Like he is really not into this at all. The Nanjiani alien they kind of talk about feels at first you're like, okay, it's gonna be on Johnny as an alien. That'll be funny. There's a couple of lines you're like, hey, yep, that's totally his voice. He usually says things that are funny. He's not, but I'm remembering other things in the past where he said that are funny. And then by the end, it's just incredibly desperate across the board. I feel like if they had just turned in the beginning and said, you know what, this movie's about Tessa Thompson and Emma Thompson working in a place called Men in Black, and just that's your movie. Unfortunately, that might not have helped the distressed asset. So unfortunately, we have this.
Yeah, and I'm glad you talked about Thompson and Hemsworth specifically, because that's actually one thing I also want to mention. I actually think she is fun in this. I think that she kind of understands how to play it, because in some ways she's the Will Smith character from the first movie in this movie, where she kind of understands the Men in Black world more than Will Smith did in his first movie, but she's like the newcomer and we get to see the movie through her eyes. And I think it once again just, I think, reaffirms how great she is as a movie star. Hemsworth, I think, makes the wrong choice with the character. I mean, Agent H is supposed to be this guy who used to be a really great agent, a really, really like good agent. And once he was part of this saving the planet mission, it went to his head. He kind of got complacent. But the problem is Hemsworth kind of plays him as a dick, and he succeeds in some way, because I actually really hated the character, and he's not a charming rogue. I will say I was happy that the movie doesn't try to romantically pair off the two characters. I was grateful for that small victory. But Hemsworth is just not fun in the film, and I think it works against what makes him fun in movies, which is he is a very hunky, good-looking guy who is overly confident in his like bulk or his strength, and that often becomes a thing that is then made fun of, especially in Ghostbusters, which I thought worked really well, where he is a very good-looking guy who is massively stupid. And that was really funny. This performance, he's supposed to be kind of dumb, but he's mostly more of just an arrogant prick. And I think also in general, if you have a character who is established as somebody who is really good with the ladies, that I think is difficult to sometimes sell as a lovable comedic character. I don't think Hemsworth does it well at all in this movie. And unfortunately, like, Nanjiani mostly is just kind of riffing in the corner. I mean, there's sometimes where like you don't actually see him, but you hear his voice, and I couldn't help but think, oh, they must have just looped that in later. Like, oh, say something funny here. Like, that's the type of thing that sort of happens. Something I cut from my review just because of space was that, you know, Rebecca Ferguson has this kind of goofy wig that she wears. It actually took me a moment to realize it was her in the movie. And she's almost like in witness protection, like in the film, where it's like, don't tell the Mission Impossible people I'm in this. Like, don't let them know I'm slumming on the side doing stuff like this. I found it really joyless. And the action sequences aren't good at all in this. And I just, the two of them together was just entirely unfun. You know, years ago, there was this conversation about, oh, maybe Lord Miller are going to do like a mashup where they do a Men in Black 21 Jump Street crossover movie. And I think, like most people, I thought, that is terrible. Please don't do that. Like, just do anything other than that. Just don't do that. After seeing this, I'm like, well, I don't want them to do that either. But now I'm almost kind of wondering what that movie would have been like. Because, yeah, I really hated this. I found it just kind of just so unfunny that it was kind of hard to sit through.
Yeah, the last thing on this is one thing I do kind of think I am going to get from a Men in Black movie, even though I don't think this is some incredible franchise, are cool aliens. And they're, none of the aliens are really interesting in this. Our friend Rachel Handler, who writes for Vulture, did a great piece, a oral history of Vincent D'Onofrio.
Yes.
In the first movie, which was a great piece and a really, really funny. And obviously, he's awesome in that movie. It's so weird. I mean, he's a cockroach. There's cockroaches coming out. It's like this incredible kind of thing. And all the aliens are just random and strange. There's always remember that great scene in the first one, too, where there's the shot of the World Trade Center in the back and the alien, like, picking up and bashing the guy against the ground. Like, there's like funny little aliens. Here the aliens feel like they're in like the background of like a fourth tier X-Men movie, right? Like none of the aliens really pop in any way at all of this.
Yeah, I would say that while watching this, because there is shape-shifting aliens like in Dark Phoenix, I did think about Dark Phoenix a decent amount, and I would rather watch that than this, yeah. Because at least that movie has some sense of like forward momentum. Also, listen, we are in an age of product placement in movies. I am not naive to think that that's going to go away anytime soon. But I would submit that the Lexus ad that happens in this movie, especially because Nanjiani's character is forced to go, that's what I'm talking about when they reveal the car in this movie. It just like it made me sad. And Emma Thompson, you know, who was in the last movie, we all remember because we're all just thinking about Men in Black 3 all the time in 2019. She has one of the two times I laughed in the movie. She has a line in this movie that I thought was kind of funny. Yeah, I'm done.
All right, so what'd you give it?
I gave it a D.
Oh, a full-on D. Wow, so do you like this more or less than Men in Black 2?
I had to think about it. It's been so long since I've seen that movie. I can't remember what grade I gave it. They are close, but I think Men in Black 2 is a lot shorter than this, which would maybe give it the advantage.
I give it a C-. I did not like it, but Thompson was enough. Both Thompsons enough were enough for me to at least be like, okay, I didn't get full into hatred, but I don't disagree with a single word that you said.
The last thing I'll say is that there is a mole in the Men in Black. That's the that's the thing. Mm. Anybody who's listening to this show, if you haven't seen the movie, you know who it is. Also, also you're right. Men in Black, the first one, is a great New York movie. This movie is like a boring, like they go to Morocco because, I don't know, a tax break or something? I don't know.
All right, now we're going to go to our second new movie of the week, and that movie is The Dead Don't Die.
What the hell was it? A wild animal?
This is really awful. Maybe the worst thing I've ever seen.
What was it, wild animals?
So what are you thinking?
I'm thinking zombies.
What?
You know, the undead. Ghouls.
The Dead Don't Die is written and directed by Jim Jarmusch. We love us some Jim Jarmusch. We've discussed Patterson on this podcast, and we discussed, what's the first movie he did? Hang on, we did Patterson, and we did Strangers in Paradise.
Which I always want to call Lost in Paradise, but mistake. Right, but yes,
Strangers in Paradise. And we discussed John Jewish. We loved Patterson, and I really love his last two movies, both Patterson and even Lovers Left Alive, Only Lovers Left Alive, excuse me, both made my top 10. So obviously very excited about this, particularly when you see that, hey, it's Bill Murray, Adam Driver, and Close Seven. He has cops, and Tilda Swinton is a coroner. Exciting stuff pretty much across the board. It starts out as like a basic kind of zombie movie. They're in this small town called Centerville. The two main cops there are Bill Murray, Cliff Robertson, played by Bill Murray, and Ronnie Peterson, played by Adam Driver. They and then Close 70 also is works with them as well. They are this Citadel is this very small town where nothing too much happens except one. There's some sort of weird thing happening with the moon. The moon is doing something strange. As we've all learned from Mr. Show, the trick when the moon is doing something strange is to blow up the moon. I don't know right. why. No one occurred. They did not do that, but they did not blow up the moon. So weird thing starts happening. As it turns out, their dead are rising, and therefore Jim Jarmusch is making himself a zombie movie. I remember back when you, Grierson, on a previous podcast, you talked about when you were interviewing Tilda Swinton, and she said, "Did you know I'm making a zombie movie with Jim Jarmusch?" And you can see that she was excited and why anyone would be excited by this, particularly because Only Lovers Left Alive not only was a good movie, but it really found something. You know, it felt like Jarmusch looking at the vampire movie, the idea of vampires, and finding his spin on it, right? Which was basically, wow, imagine living forever and being like Jim Jarmusch and like cool guy and constantly seeing like the way and basically being a vampire became this kind of analogy for getting old and feeling like all the stuff that you love, nobody cares about anymore. And basically being a vampire turned you into like a vintage expert, so on. And it was very kind of funny and very well done and very cool and very Jarmuschian. And then he has Patterson, which I think is, I honestly, the more I think about Patterson, the more I love that movie. It's a perfect Adam Driver performance. So seeing it back here, it's very exciting. I am sad to say, Grierson, I really don't think this movie's very good. And there's several reasons for that. One of the things we've talked about on this podcast, Grierson, is we want filmmakers to kind of rise up and meet this cultural moment, in the world of Trump and the world of like the basically this terrifying moment that we kind of live in like human history. And we want to see what filmmakers do to stand up to it. This in some ways feels like Jarmusch kind of reacting to this political moment. There's even a character played by Steve Buscemi who wears a Make America Great hat. And the hat's not exactly Make America
Great. No, it's like a riff on that.
Yeah.
It Makes America White Again, maybe, or something like that. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, which is, again, the kind of level of joke we're going at here, is that like it feels like Jarmusch wanting to make some sort of commentary on the masses and our current moment, but kind of not being able to invest himself anymore other than being snide, dismissive, and maybe even helpless. And I found that frustrating because I feel like I'd love to see what Jim Jarmusch, I think he was a wise, smart filmmaker, kind of invested in trying to do this. And the second thing is obviously, just like with vampire movies, there's been a ton of zombie movies. I don't think he has anything new to add to that. I thought he had something new to add to with the vampire movie here. This feels like he's just kind of doodling. There's this weird meta aspect that kind of comes out of it that feels almost as if he's just like, you know what? I don't actually have any ideas left on this one. I really don't. I'm only halfway in on this. We're all just kidding around, right? And I found that frustrating, particularly for someone who I really think, as his last two movies have been so, so good. This feels a little too indulgent, a little too dismissive, and a little bit too removed. I got to tell you, this is one of the more disappointing movies of the year for me, Grierson.
I'm going to defend it slightly. It is too indulgent. And it is too smug, and it has the problem that I think we always, or I at least refer to as like the Ocean's 11 thing, where it didn't have the problem, which is everybody in this cast is having such a fun time. Will that fun actually translate to the audience? It's funny you mentioned the Tilda Swinton interview, because I thought about it a lot while watching this movie. Like, these people seem like they're enjoying making this. I'm not sure if it entirely connects with an audience. I think it is too lazy. I think it is smug in certain ways. And yet I have to say that there is something, even though I also agree, I don't think he does anything entirely new with the zombie genre, but I have to say that there is something that I did connect with in this movie. And it's actually a word that you use, which is helpless. There is something that I actually found kind of affecting about the dead don't die, specifically in the sense that while it is overdone, that Jarmusch sort of feels like he feels resigned to the idea that humanity is doomed, and he doesn't have much of an answer for that. And the characters don't either. That there is sort of an idea that, I mean, what is interesting to me is that everybody in this movie is aware of zombie movies. This is not a zombie film where no one's heard of zombies and zombies don't exist. And so it's a new, terrifying thing that happens to the characters in the movie. Everybody in the Dead Don't Die knows what zombies are. People reference zombie movies. They talk about them. And one of the things I think is actually pretty funny in this movie is that when there is the first zombie attacks happen, an Am Driver and Bill Murray go, Am Driver says, well, this looks like zombies. And that's actually funny, I think, because it's an acknowledgement that, like, oh, this isn't a surprise to these people. They actually know what zombies are. The movie is, the meta quality of this movie is hit or miss. I think sometimes it works. I think other times it does not work. And your mileage may vary on how you feel about that stuff. But for me, what I think ultimately is effective is, number one, I think it's actually pretty... I think it's more funny than it's not. I actually think there's like a lot of amusing stuff that kind of happens just because of the cast that he's assembled for this movie. I laughed a decent amount. And also, I just feel like as the film goes on, Patterson is a more kind of melancholy, bittersweet kind of movie. And Only Lovers Left Alive, that movie is kind of the same way. Even going back to Stranger Than Paradise, that movie is also kind of bittersweet and melancholy and like that. This movie actually feels depressed. It actually legitimately feels depressed. It's a movie that feels like when the zombies show up, people freak out. They don't know how to handle it. But the humor does not, in fact, make you feel better as you are watching it. If anything, it actually makes everything kind of feel worse because the zombies keep coming. The zombies keep attacking. They keep eating people and killing people along the way. And another thing I think is sort of interesting about this movie is that depending on the character in the movie, the zombies represent different things. Steve Buscemi plays essentially the Fox right-wing loving guy. He's the one that's wearing the MAGA hat in the movie. And the zombies actually represent like immigrants coming to America and like ruining America and making it worse, as opposed to other characters in the movie where zombies mean or represent different types of things. I mean, this is a movie that clearly references George Romero. The fact that the movie is set in Pennsylvania does not feel like an accident since it's Pittsburgh for the first Night of the Living Dead. All of this stuff is very kind of apparent and obvious. But at the same time, I think that what Jarmusch is doing is if he's not reinventing the zombie movie, which I don't think he is in fact saying like, this is how I, Jim Jarmusch, feel right now, which is that everything is fucked and that we have fucked the planet because there's also an environmental thing that goes on, Arctic fracking or whatever it is, or global, or, you know, whatever they call the fracking that's going on has shifted the planet. That's why the zombies are happening. It is, to quote our current president, it is a low energy movie. I think it is unfortunate for Jarmusch that he has cast this movie the way that he has. So I think that there is an expectation that this movie is going to be more of a rollicking lark. But within about 20 minutes of seeing this at Cannes, I was like, oh, that's actually not the movie that he is making. He's actually making a thing that's sort of like, yeah, this is kind of the way I feel about the world right now. And I have to say, that's kind of the way I feel about the world right now, too. And it leads to smugness, and it leads to a certain amount of just kind of a resignation and a shrug quality, because that's what this movie is. It is a shrug, and I acknowledge that. But even though this movie does not use Tom Waits well, and by that I mean it uses Tom Waits in a way that I don't like Tom Waits being used, which he's like kind of the wacky eccentric character who tells you what the movie's about in certain ways. When we got to the ending of this film, I thought, this is not a great Jarmusch film, but I think it lands where it's supposed to. I think it connects in the way it's supposed to. It is a minor work from him, obviously. But I gotta say, like, walking out of it, I did feel kind of overwhelmed by the experience of, yeah, everything is fucked. And the movie, I think, makes the argument, not only is the world fucked and we're all fucked, this is just kind of the end. That we are, in fact, going to go out more with a whimper than a bang. And that kind of resignation that the film kind of exudes, embodies. It was my jam, and I was willing to accept it. Though the things that you cite, I can't argue with. There are legitimately big problems with this movie, but I think it communicates what it's supposed to effectively enough that I was willing to go with it.
Yeah, and there's something about that shrug. I think I get it, but there's something that when you compare that shrug with a lot of like self-referential hipness, I feel like the message just starts to curdle, right? And not curdle in an engaging way. Like it feels like a guy sitting outside and lobbing milk duds at you, right? Or lobbing milk duds at the world, I guess. It's kind of what the movie feels like. It just kind of feels like, and to do that, like, then to add in so much of this meta stuff, like the idea that there's a woo PS when RZA plays a delivery man and it's called woo PS, the whole joke with Bill Murray and Adam Driver maybe being aware of their movie that they're in. I don't know what that adds to the experience other than to just remind you that, like, I'm Jim Jarmusch and I have a lot of cool people in my movies.
And don't forget the keychain that Adam Driver has at one point, yes, in this movie.
Exactly.
It's also that same type of thing.
And it's frustrating, too, because I actually kind of love Adam Driver in this movie.
I think he's great. Yeah.
And this is one of those, Driver's becoming one of those actors. I've not seen the Don Quixote movie, but he's one of those actors that I'll kind of like, I'm kind of hip to whatever he's doing right now. And like, I feel like he's on like a really, he's a really solid role right now with kind of everything that he's doing. He is, there's a piece on Vulture that talked about this as well. He is legit really funny in this movie. And the line readings are funny. Him driving a tiny car is funny. Like just the number of things he does in this movie that are just kind of like, he has the right reaction to the movie. And I feel like he's the one maybe on the best wavelength of what you're talking about, what Jarmusch is trying to do. There's something kind of deadpan, end of the world, about Driver's performance that I think is really kind of interesting and really kind of fun. I don't think Bill Murray is on that realm. I don't think Bill Murray is quite right in this, to be entirely honest. I don't think he really ever works. And they're a weird match. Like, I feel like that's a match that could work, but they're just not really in the same place. And it's kind of a bummer. There's several people like that. I think Carol Kane has one scene that is really funny, but then she's not in the movie anymore. We'll move on from that. I love Tilda Swinton. And I love that anytime you put Tilda Swinton in a movie, you're basically acknowledging, like, okay, yeah, she's kind of an alien being at times. And I get it. I would argue this movie maybe floors that a little bit too hard to the point of, like, I don't know. It's just another one of those things that feels that's the overarching problem is I get what you're saying. And that's something that I get it. Like, it's something I understand. And I don't necessarily, that's not my jam, to be honest with you. And I feel like there is something very, well, then fuck it then, that I find frustrating as a person during a time where there's lots of people working really hard to try. Like, maybe they're going to fail, but like, there's lots of people out there that are working really hard to actually try to make the world a little bit better place, that I find it frustrating to watch someone kind of sniff at it and be like, yeah, we're fucked. Why don't you just accept this? And then to do that with as much kind of self-referential cool guy stuff that I loved Only Lovers Left Alive. I think some of that works in that. And Patterson, I think, is its own kind of being that exists outside of that. But the Jarmusch thing is Coffee and Cigarettes is one of those movies where it's like a cool Jarmusch vibe. He can coast on that a little bit, but when you add it to this, I have to say, I found it kind of irritating.
Yeah, and I get that. I think for me, and there's a lot of that stuff that's off-putting. And I agree with you about Bill Murray, because Bill Murray to me is, this is the Bill Murray that you don't want in a movie, who's just kind of, you can't tell if it's laconic or he's just, you know, just doesn't.
He's just not into it,
yeah. I think Chloe Zevigny is actually pretty darn good in it also. I actually like Tilda Swinton in this. Because I think that she is the eccentric character, big surprise. And I think that she knows her lane and she is in that lane just fine in this movie. I think that she works perfectly well. You know, for me, and this is such a fine line, but for me, while watching The Dead Don't Die, a lot of the self-referential stuff, a lot of the kind of weird doodling, as you described it, the weird kind of digressions. We haven't even talked about Selena Gomez and that whole thing. I mean, there are like these like things in the movie. There are just like these like side little jams that are happening. These like little riffs that are going on. To me, it did not communicate so much like, well, fuck it, I don't care. It's more as just this kind of like not knowing what to do. Not, you know, I for me, there is a certain amount of, again, helpless. There's a sort of feeling of like, I don't know how to function in this world. And to me, that's the thing I think that Jarmusch is communicating. I don't know. Like the things that I have, the things how I operate in the world no longer seem to make any sense. And for me, that some of the self-referential stuff seems to be speaking to that. The, you know, pretentious or not, the idea that some of the characters might be aware that they're in fact in a Jim Jarmusch film, to me is supposed to suggest that the whole movie is itself unraveling and falling apart in a certain way, because whatever it is that Jim Jarmusch does to make a film, to make sense of his own world, which was done so beautifully in Patterson. I mean, that may be my favorite film he's ever made.
Yeah, I think so too. Yeah, I'd probably be mine too.
To me, this is the, in some ways, it is not nearly as good, but it's a companion piece in a certain way. That movie is him figuring something out. This is him not being able to figure something out. And I, there was enough fascination for me of like him sort of like running around in circles in a way that I found moving, touching, interesting enough. Though, you know, I remember before we went to Cannes, or before I went to Cannes, I mean, we sort of mentioned like movies we were looking forward to and people, movies, summer movies that people, our readers and listeners, were excited about. This movie, as soon as I saw it, I'm like, oh, this is not going to be the movie that people want. This is not going to be the thing that they were hoping for. It's not a fun lark. Even I acknowledge that. But, you know, I'm not a, you know, current mood on Twitter person, but this, like I said, this seeped into my bones in a way where it's like, I think it does express something. And we can talk about whether or not that's the best way to operate in the world right now. I think what you said is actually very well said and well put. But there is a value in having this voice as another thing in terms of how people feel in the world right now. And I think it's successful enough. But that being said, just barely.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's just, there's a little bit of a, hey, look, it's Iggy Pop as a zombie.
You would like, know that's him. Yeah, because he's,
I'm out. Yeah. All right, so what'd you give it?
I give it a B-.
I give it a C, so I'm not that far. I didn't hit. Driver to me is so fun in this movie that like he kind of kept me. Again, this is happening pretty much in every Adam Driver movie, whether I like the movie or not. When he's on screen, I like the movie. Like that's just kind of where he is right now. So yeah. So he's in a place.
He's funny in glasses. Just the glasses he wears in this movie are in fact amusing.
I could watch. I'm at some point. This movie definitely reeks of a movie that's going to have a lot of gifts made of it someday. And the scene where he just drives up in the little tiny car.
Oh yeah,
that just kills me.
It's. I forgot about that. That's also very funny in this movie. Yes.
All right, so that is The Dead Don't Die. We're halfway through our four movies. One of these may take a while to discuss. One of them may not that we have left going on, but we'll probably talk about the one that will take a while to discuss. Now it's our third new movie of the week. That movie is Rolling Thunder Review, a Bob Dylan story by Martin Scorsese.
The idea was to put a tour up.
We should be playing 20,000 seats. But instead, he wanted all these small venues.
We're really running short of time. Want to introduce Bob Dylan.
Boy, sure hope we get to Boston on time.
Where have you been?
The tour was a catastrophe.
Where have you been? It wasn't a success. Not if you measure success in terms of profit.
Takes a deep breath. Rolling Thunder Review, a Bob Dylan story by Martin Scorsese, is directed by, you guessed it, Martin Scorsese. This is the second Martin Scorsese documentary about Bob Dylan. More than a decade ago, he did No Direction Home, which was a PBS American Masters Thing that was also available on DVD, put out by Paramount. Didn't get a theatrical release. This is through Netflix. It got a small theatrical release, but it's also streaming on Netflix right now. And as opposed to No Direction Home, which was more of a origin story sort of thing about Bob Dylan, his early years in the 1960s, Rolling Thunder Review is about a very specific period of time in Bob Dylan's life and career. Is based around the 1975 leg of the Rolling Thunder tour, where, listen, there's two types of people who are listening to this: people who are really into Dylan and people who are not really into Dylan. I'm going to paraphrase this for the people who are not super into Dylan. In 1975, Dylan was in the midst of sort of a comeback in his career. He had put out Blood on the Tracks, one of his best albums, his breakup album, his divorce album. And he did this tour called Rolling Thunder, where he took, gathered up a bunch of his old buddies like Joan Baez and Roger McGuinn and Joni Mitchell, and went on tour with them. And it's kind of considered one of like the iconic tours in Bob Dylan's career. That woebegone film, Ronaldo and Clara, the only film that Dylan directed, was made during this time. If you ever have 4 hours to see it, don't see something else instead. It is absolutely terrible. But the concert footage from that movie is partly used in Rolling Thunder Review. Martin Scorsese has made a documentary about 2.5 hours long about that tour and what that experience was like. He, like with No Direction Home, it's mostly footage that he has been given from Bob Dylan's people that he has compiled. But, and it's rare to say a spoiler alert in a documentary, there is also new stuff. And some of that stuff from talking heads, talking about the experience of being there at the concert, or making, you know, filming it, or what it was like to just sort of experience it. Those are from people who are not real. So part of the experience of watching Rolling Thunder Review is wondering what's real, what's not, which ties into the overall idea of the Rolling Thunder tour, which is about Bob Dylan wearing a whiteface on stage and essentially performing with a mask on, and the idea of playing with masks and personas and what's real and what's not. And Rolling Thunder Review, the documentary, plays into that same idea. I saw this movie on the big screen. They screened it at Netflix, and I point that out because, you know, most Netflix films you do not need to see in a theater. You can see them at home. I haven't seen Call Me Maybe, not Call Me Maybe, that's the song, Always Be My Maybe. I have a feeling you can see that at home and it's okay. You can probably see the Allison Williams movie at home. That's probably fine. If you are in a city where Rolling Thunder Review is showing on the big screen and you like Dylan, you should go see it that way, because the best stuff in this movie by far is the concert stuff. What's great about Bob Dylan, and I wrote about this for Pace when I reviewed this for Pace this week, is that we now have all these like eras of Bob Dylan on film. Whether it's Masked and Anonymous from the 2000s or Don't Look Back from the 1960s, there are these eras, these waves of Dylan that we see. I've seen a lot of that stuff. This, to me, is some of the most magnetic concert stuff I've ever seen from Bob Dylan. He animates songs that I didn't necessarily love before, like Isis from Desire, which was about ready to come out during this time, and it is absolutely hypnotizing. This is some of the most vital, extraordinary, like just live performances of Dylan's I've ever seen. What is never acknowledged in the movie, by the way, is something I wonder, which is how much is cocaine driving this? Which is not a criticism, it's just a fact. I mean, Bob, you know, Martin Scorsese made The Last Waltz a couple of years later and had to like remove cocaine from Neil Young's nose from his performance because Neil Young's like, yeah, can you get that out of there? Like, I don't want people seeing that. I mean, drugs were a huge part of the rock and roll life of the 1970s, and certainly the touring world. That's not mentioned at all in this movie. The concert stuff is fabulous. It's really, really terrific. I'm a little more mixed on the other stuff, which is what's real, what's not. We're just kind of fucking around. And so if Sharon Stone talks about like going on tour, did she really go on tour? That guy who says that he was like filming this stuff, is that really the guy? why is there a Robert Altman character who shows up in this movie? Now there's enough stuff that if you want to find out what's not real, you can go online and find that stuff out. I knew some of it going in. Other stuff I had to look up, and my suspicions were confirmed about what's real and what's not in this. I think that stuff can be somewhat distracting. Actually, take out the word somewhat. That stuff can be distracting in this movie. I think what's also a bit off about this film is that I think Scorsese oversells the idea that the movie is supposed to be in some ways a commentary on America during the bicentennial. That in some ways that the Rolling Thunder tour was grappling with America at that moment in time as America was shifting, insert, you know, Watergate footage or Nixon footage or, you know, Jimmy Carter footage. I think that stuff is not convincing. I would also say that I have never been a big believer that the Rolling Thunder tour was that amazing. There was a bootleg album from 2002, a live album, which I have listened to dutifully over the years, but never really loved. There's a new 14-disc Rolling Thunder thing. I'm probably not going to listen to that very much on Spotify, but I may give it a spin or two, but not all 14 hours. Dear God, I have a life. But the film, like the footage of the concerts, is so powerful and so affecting that I think, okay, maybe this is not one of his like hallmark tours, but it's pretty damn great. All that being said, the best performance in this thing, and you probably, if you've been following along on Twitter, people talking about it, the best performance in this movie is from Joni Mitchell, who plays her song Coyote, which she wrote around the time of this. She also performed it in The Last Waltz as well. Is absolutely magnificent, one of the best moments of this entire thing. As a Dylan fan, I have to say this about Rolling Thunder Review. It is like a lot of recent stuff that has come out from the Bob Dylan camp. Is both overrated and yet a perfect encapsulation of what is so magnetic and mystical and fabulous about Bob Dylan after all these years. I think this movie has been overpraised. I think people tend to do that with Bob Dylan stuff that's made by Martin Scorsese. It's kind of a can't miss. And yet, if you ask me right now, hey, Tim, it's playing across the street. Do you want to go see it again? My answer would be absolutely yes.
Yeah, I actually find myself landing more on what you said at the end than a lot of the other stuff. We'll get into the stuff that's not real and real and so on. But like, yeah, I don't know if you know this, Gerson, but like Martin Scorsese, pretty good at making entertaining movies. And it's funny, there is, on one hand, there's obviously the concert stuff, which is amazing. And I think that like, to see, there's one moment where someone says in the movie, there's like a reporter, I think it's Ratso from Rolling Stone, asked him like, this feels like some of your more animated performances. And that's a fair statement to make. If you, like, depending on how well you know Dylan, I feel like you and I, we know Dylan pretty well, actually. I wouldn't put us in the 99th percentile, but I think we're certainly in the top 10. I think so. And to see some of his performances in this movie, yes, they do perhaps seem a little stimulant aided, but they are intense. There are some absolutely amazing. I'm glad that you said Isis. That song rocks in this movie. That song is so good. Hurricane, there's also a terrific performance of Hurricane in this movie. The movie, every time there's a performance, pretty much every, the Joni Mitchell thing's good. There's a great Patti Smith thing in this. There's some really good Joan Baez stuff in this, but it's mostly Dylan. All that stuff is the movie. There's not a single time where the movie stops for a musical performance that I didn't appreciate it. I really kind of loved every single bit of that. But I will say, I kind of like, one of the things I like about Scorsese's approach in this is he touches a little on the generational stuff, though I think it's almost worth it to have some of that Jimmy Carter stuff. I feel like the idea that Jimmy Carter spoke openly about how Dylan like could be a, like, I don't know how much he's overselling it when the president of the United States at the time is saying, I feel like the world can be a little bit of a better place through the music and poetry of Bob Dylan. Like, I don't know how much Scorsese has to oversell that when literally the president, back when we had presidents, says that in real time during that. I think it's a very famous thing that Carter said, but like to hear it and to see it in the context of like, oh no, this is what was going on when Carter says that. I don't know if that is overselling. I think that is kind of a important vibe, an important thing to get across. The fake stuff, I found it generally in the spirit of Dylan enough to where it's pretty entertaining. And I think it's kind of fun because I did watch this at home. I didn't watch this in a theater. But I will say I was excited enough to watch this. This was not a movie where, like, I checked the score of the Cardinals game while on my phone while I was watching this thing. Like, this was I made this as immersive as I possibly could because I was really excited about this. And I do think that it is one of the things that's fun about watching it is it's clear early on, okay, yeah, I don't know who this Van Dorp character is. I think some of this stuff, like, I think he's taking credit for stuff that Dylan himself filmed, and you realize, okay, he's messing around. And by the time that Sharon Stone is showing up and Bob Dylan is saying, oh, yeah, I got the face makeup thing by watching a kiss, going to a kiss show, you're like, okay, this movie's just fucking with me. And then when Tanner 88 shows up, you're like, okay, obviously now the jig is up. I actually feel like that's kind of fun. I think it leads to the, like, whatever your thought, I think I like this. I listened to this album more than, I think more often, you know, I have the same bootleg. And I listened, not the new 14-hour one, but the old one. And I listened to it a bunch, actually. I got kind of excited. I've heard that Joan Baez, Dylan combo many, many times, just through iTunes. It's an old audio program that people used to use. And I've heard that, like, a bunch of times. So to see it live was very, very exciting. And so I actually like this album. I like this tour maybe a little bit more than you do. But more to the point, the legend of this tour with Allen Ginsberg on this tour and Sam Shepard, who we've not talked about being on this tour, the legend of this tour is such a big deal. Like, my little side personal note, my agent, my literary agent, was working as an oil dude in, like, 1975 and literally was stopped to say, hey, Dylan's in town. And the people, like, you see people handing out pamphlets in this movie. He's told me for years about how he saw the Rolling Thunder tour. Now, he may be lying to me. This might just be, like, a baby boomer, I'm getting cool credit for this sort of thing. But, like, that's kind of the cultural impact of this tour. It became such a, I agree that I wish they would get more into the drug aspect of it. On the other hand, I kind of like that the movies, like, the Scorsese's approach is, you know what, whatever you've heard, it's the legend, right? Some of this is true, some of it doesn't matter. There's kind of a storyteller's relish of that I kind of appreciated. Like, and frankly, one thing we've not discussed at all are Dylan's actual interviews for this documentary, including the time I joked about Dylan saying that he got the idea for putting the white face on from Kiss. He doesn't say that in a 1975 interview. He says that in a 2018 interview. Dylan is kind of having some fun here too. And that was actually exciting for me to watch. It was exciting to see Dylan kind of actively fucking with us a little bit. I did kind of appreciate, seeing that kind of fight and kind of spunk still kind of in him a little bit. I really kind of like the first interview he apparently has sat down for video interview in like 10 years. It was exciting to watch him kind of getting together with, frankly, another kind of master artist and have fun with it. That was fun for me to watch. And to me, the way the movie ends, and I mean, Bob Dylan's still alive, but he's not shot down by snipers, even in this slightly fictionalized version. The way this movie ends, when you consider Dylan's career up to this point where he kind of stopped touring for a while and he goes through this divorce and he kind of comes barreling out of the gates with this, the way this movie ends, showing what not only came next for Dylan, but would come forever for Dylan after that, I actually say I found it surprisingly poignant in a way where for a guy who had stopped touring before this and whatever, maybe you don't think that, maybe a lot of people don't think that the Rolling Thunder review was a big tour. Dylan clearly does. And I think it's something that kind of pushed him onward. And I think it's something that Scorsese thinks kind of pushed him onward after that. The way that kind of ends, I was kind of really kind of touched by it. So yeah, I think I like this a lot more than you do.
Yeah, it's actually kind of funny because actually that's how I ended my review, is actually talking about how, without revealing it, like, I think that there's something really poignant about where it ends and what it suggests about the idea of what he did next, but also what it's about for him. Like, why Dylan does what he does and what he's interested in as an artist in terms of engaging with his audience. I realize, because I have not yet watched this at home, I can now pause to look for things.
I did that.
In that ending.
yes.
because I mean, when it shows up, I kind of, you know, gasped a little bit, I have to say, in terms of where it ends. I think that everything that you said makes total sense. I think the question is always with Dylan, how much of it is fun for its own sake, which is not inconsiderable, not a small amount, but does it add to anything more? I think that sometimes those things don't always add up to as much as I would kind of in terms of the things that aren't real or the things where they're kind of fucking around and like that. And also, I think for me, like, as a big Dylan fan, I know that the fucking around is sort of part of the fun. And so this movie's brand of it is not all that surprising, I suppose. I think that's, for me, is like, oh, this is a thing that he does. Like, this is, you know, and one of the things I said is, like, in some ways, you also, it's the pleasure of his memoir, where when you're reading things and it's kind of like, is that true? Is that right? Is that really what happened? And that's always been kind of the fun with him. So, yeah, and I'm glad you liked it as much as you did. There's a lot of stuff I really enjoyed, but there's other stuff where I'm like, oh, right. Like, I know this kind of thing that you do, but I kind of, what is so strong about the footage is that not that the fake stuff is lying, but the concert stuff doesn't lie. It in fact is so powerful and so, like, affecting. I mean, for me, like, to see the performance that's on that 2002 live album of Hurricane is kind of amazing to see. Like, just, like, you know, like, just seeing that is kind of exceptional. To see that stuff come to life is really great. Just the fact that they actually like open the shows with them behind a curtain and then raise the curtain. Like, that's incredible. To actually see that is really, really great. I think the fake stuff or the fucking around stuff, it's fun. I do think there's too much of it. I think it creates, it made me really interested in the real story. And one of the things I sort of argued in the review I wrote was, like, if you want to know that stuff, there is a thing called the internet. You can find that stuff.
Yeah, but that's still fun, right? Like, to me, one of the things that Scorsese's saying is, like, yeah, you know what? This, not all this stuff might have happened, but, like, when it's the old newspaper guy's maxim, when faced with the fact and the legend, print the legend. This is a movie that prints the legend, and I kind of loved that for it.
No, and I agree. That was my argument. Like, that's what Scorsese's doing, and I can appreciate that to a certain degree. But I'm not sure if it entirely. I mean, in some ways, what's funny is it made me want to revisit Masked and Anonymous, which I haven't seen in quite some time, which was so brutally just derided at the time, where clearly to me that movie was saying, no, this is us playing with the ideas of Dylan's persona and the Dylan characters. Though I will say, I'm not there. I think it's still the strongest version of that, because to me, they're both great, but with I'm Not There, what I think makes it better than Rolling Thunder Review is I'm Not There, everything feels up for grabs. Everything feels like there's a possibility for discovery and rediscovery and reinterpretation. Whereas this one, I feel like the things that are made up feel more within the confines of a certain kind of way of making a film like this, where I'm Not There really felt like, holy shit, this is a completely new way of thinking about Dylan. These are, admittedly, very fine things that most people who see this movie will not matter to them. They will not care.
Also, this movie is a good reminder of why David Cross has played Allen Ginsberg in several movies. Good Lord, they look exactly the same now. It's really terrifying.
Susan went to see this with me, and she also loved it. And Susan said, like, yeah, like, David Cross is kind of like put on Earth for that reason, right? Right. There's no other reason. Like, that's sort of, yeah.
That's at least why David Cross got old. I think I'll give him Mr. Show, and of course going on the Will Leach Show. But I did say getting old enough to play Allen Ginsberg twice.
And never knew. And never knew. Don't ever forget. Never,
Of course.
All
right, Gerson. So I'm a little disappointed that you didn't like it as much as me, but what'd you give it?
I give it a B+.
I give it an A-. Fine. We're not that far off.
We're not that far off. To me, that this is one of those movies that is an embodiment of what separates a B+ from A-. Really, really good. I wasn't quite as ecstatic all the way through. But it's... Between this and the Bruce Springsteen thing, which, of course, we didn't talk about because it didn't get a theatrical release, I've really been happy with some of these like bigger kind of Netflix... specials and series that they've kind of done. I think they've done a really good job with these. My final thing I want to say is I kind of would love for Scorsese to make a Dylan thing where it's not like he's been given footage and actually gets to like do something on his own. That's actually kind of the thing I found myself kind of craving.
I know is if I'm a Netflix executive, I'm like, okay, cool. You happy with this, Scorsese? Please finish The Irishman. You've been working on that for like, you're going to have to digitally age De Niro again because that movie has gone on for so long. All right. Now we go to our final movie of the week. Our final movie is Shaft.
You know, they say that cat Shaft is a bad mother.
Shut your mouth.
Ignore him. He thinks he's a black James Bond.
That dude was real. He think he was me.
Shaft, parentheses, 2019, close parentheses, is the latest Shaft film. Not to be confused with the Shaft from 2000 and the Shaft from 1971. But it once again stars Samuel Jackson is not the original Shaft. He is John Shaft II. But you can just call him Shaft. He plays Shaft, who, if you saw the 2000 film, which was directed by the recently deceased John Singleton, in that movie, they established that the original Shaft, played by Richard Roundtree, was his uncle. They changed that in this movie. Apparently, he lied to him that he's actually his dad now. So that's his dad. Who is Shaft II's son, you might wonder? His name is J.J. Shaft. He's played by Jesse T. Usher, who I had to look this up because I did not remember. He was Will Smith's kid in Independence Day Resurgence, which was a movie. In this movie, J.J., his best friend, is acting really kind of weird and ends up dead because he'd had drug problems. People think, oh no, he overdosed. We knew this was going to happen, but JJ is convinced that he was murdered. Why was he murdered? Who was behind it? There's only one man that can help JJ figure that out. That is John Shaft Jr., or John Shaft II, played by Samuel L. Jackson. They haven't seen each other for a very long time. You might say they're estranged, but they're going to get back together, and they're going to solve this mystery. But the thing is, John Shaft II, you know, he's like an old school man's man. You know, he isn't into this like millennial shit. He isn't like lemon bars, which are not like, or lemon towers, I guess they're called. He's like lemon towers. He isn't like frou-frou stuff. He isn't like texting. He just thinks that stuff's a bunch of bullshit. He's a man's man. He knows how the way things are. But they're like, you know, they're opposites, but they attract and they work together to solve this crime. Most people hate the new Shaft. At least most people I've talked to think it's really, really terrible. I do not think it's good. I want to preface this. I do not think this movie is good. However, I will say that I actually had more fun at this movie, especially after watching Men in Black International, which, as I mentioned, is god awful. This movie actually has a little life to it, though, which I did at least appreciate. I think a lot of it has to do with Samuel L. Jackson. It is not a newsflash to say that Samuel L. Jackson is funny when he curses a lot, but I have to admit, there's a lot of stuff in this movie that when he curses, I did think is kind of funny. Watching Samuel L. Jackson just be aggrieved is enjoyable, and he is aggrieved a lot in this film. Granted, there is transphobic jokes in this movie. There are homophobic jokes in this movie. Most of the humor between him and his son is, I know you're gay because you're not a macho guy like I am. And a lot of that stuff is just disgusting. And there's no no question about that. But the Samuel L. Jackson, like, persona is at least entertaining enough that I was willing to at least try to ignore the stuff that's kind of vile in this film. Also, I think Alexandra Shipp is really good in this. She plays Sasha, who is JJ's crush, essentially, in this movie. But because he's a sensitive millennial dude, he just doesn't have the cojones to really kind of like win her over. In the world of this movie, that's how they think about men. But she's actually, I think, really fun. I did not remember what she had been from. She had been in the recent X-Men movies, but because those movies are not entirely memorable, that's why I didn't remember her. I think she's going to be a massive star. I'm entirely behind that because I think she's really delightful in this. Regina Hall, she shows up. She's been really good in a lot of stuff recently. People talk about Support the Girls a lot, and she's really good in that. I would also give some love to The Hate U Give, which I think is one of the most underrated movies of last year. She's also really good in this. She doesn't have much to do. This is a dumb action comedy. It's directed by Tim Story, and it's not very smart. The investigation's not very interesting. And most of the comedic premise of this movie is Shaft the Second is like this, and JJ's like that, and they're different. They don't see things the same way. Hilarity ensues. Not a lot of hilarity ensues, but I found it at least not inert the way I found Men in Black International. And at least it seemed to be there are some ideas behind trying to make this movie kind of entertaining. It's not successful, but it's lively enough that I was like, not hating my life, as opposed to a certain movie I saw this week. Do not consider this in any way, shape, or form a recommendation.
Shaft, this didn't make me hate my life. Tim Grierson.
Yeah.
Screen International.
I texted a friend and actually said, Shaft, not terrible. That's like, so yeah. Blurb away.
I mean, I guess I kind of understand what you're saying. No, I will say, to me, Samuel L. Jackson in this is a little bit, I mean, we actually did the big ranking of Samuel L. Jackson movies for Vulture, and one of the more controversial things, because he's made so many movies, was we just had a big pile of movies where we basically just said, yeah, he's just playing Samuel L. Jackson here. It's impossible to rank these. That's all he's doing. I would now classify that bucket of movies as Samuel L. Jackson as he is in the Capital One commercials with Spike Lee and Charles Barkley.
He doesn't swear in those, though. That's the problem.
He doesn't. But like, and so that's why this is a little bit better, I guess. To me, this is Samuel L. Jackson very much in a, all right, where's my lines? What do you want me to hit? I'll bug out my eyes and I'll say motherfucker and we'll do what we've got to do and we'll move on to the next thing. It is, I suppose that can be in the same way that I'm sure it was, it's funny. It was kind of entertaining to watch some of the old masters go to Vegas and belt out the hits that they've been doing for 50 years. It's kind of fun to hear him say motherfucker. I actually think the movie picks up a little bit of steam when Richard Roundtree finally shows up. I think he's actually, he kind of has a good energy that, to go off the younger Shaft that I think the movie kind of needs. But yeah, man, I'm sorry. This movie, first off, this movie looks like shit.
It looks terrible. I think Ignati said in his review that it looks like a rejected TV pilot in terms of its production design, which is a great line. Yeah, it looks terrible. Anyway, go ahead.
It really looks like, I'm not even as good at reading that stuff as you are, but this movie looks like crap. This movie just looks like it reminded me of like early Kevin Smith at times, which is about as bad of a thing as I could possibly say. So yeah, and I actually think Jesse Usher is not that great in this. I feel like he cutes it up a little bit too much for this. I think that you want, particularly when you have the inevitable moment where the kid realizes, I'm Shaft, I'm John Shaft's son, and like gets tougher. I feel like you need a little hint of that. I feel like he's a little cartoonish, really kind of start to finish in this. I really don't think he works that well. Regina Hall is awesome. We know how much great Regina Hall is. She is like, she pops up when the movie needs her to and is Shaft, why don't you protect our boy? And then leaves. And that's kind of all that happens. And so I have to say, I understand what you're saying. I still think it's pretty.
Yeah, it is junky in a way that's not entirely unpleasant. That's the best I can say about this movie, which is, I mean, there is a scene in an Uber in this movie.
Yeah.
Where I mean, I was clearly like in whatever kind of mood I was in, because even like that scene just kind of made me laugh. Because I'm like, wait, so what's happening? Like, so their car's been shot up, so they have to go somehow to the next crime location to do action movie stuff. So like riding an Uber, and there were just things like that, like kind of like throughout the film where it's just like incredibly stupid.
Can we also talk about the fact, here's how it's funny, because they're the villain in this movie and there is eventually a villain. I think he has like four scenes. Is speaking of Jim Jarmusch, isn't he the villain in The Limits of Control, or the hitman in The Limits of Control?
Yes.
And so like a powerful actor, interesting guy. Like, here's how little the villain is given to do on this. I'm on the Wikipedia page for Shaft right now. There are 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 11 people mentioned on the Wikipedia page. He is not one of them. He's actually the villain.
He may have had his team scrub him from the movie.
Yeah. He's literally not even mentioned in the cast. Method Man, who shows up with a cigar and hat, gets a little higher billing, is actually on this page. Yeah, I don't know. It's so junky. That it's so junky, and it's so, and it really has not been thought past anything more than, what if Shaft had a millennial son, right? Like, that's really.
Oh, I mean, that's entirely. What if Shaft had a millennial son and money? Like, maybe we can make money off of this. I always mispronounce that actor's name, by the way, but it's Isaac D. Bancoli. I mean, I'm probably
bad. And he's great. He's great in The Limits.
He's great in The Limits of Control. He's been in a ton of, Claire Denis stuff. He's been in a lot of like really good stuff. And also this movie, not only like when he is revealed, it is kind of like, oh, I love that actor. I'm just going to ruin it. And then he gets killed pretty quickly right afterwards. Like, it is really like, oh, love that actor. Oh, I guess he's dead now. That's kind of it. He basically shows up for like a week, and then that's about it. That's fine. This movie is just, it is funny, because there's been a lot of conversation, because the two major big releases this week were Shaft and Men in Black International. Both movies got bad reviews. Obviously, we feel the same way about these two movies, and we're kind of reaching that point now with this summer where people are kind of like, is this like a bad summer? Like, there's been like a lot of bad big summer movies, and I think people are kind of like becoming sort of like crestfallen about this summer. In terms of the bad stuff we have seen this summer, Shaft is at least junky in a way that it actually seems like some of the people are kind of alive in it, whereas like most air stuff I feel like we've seen has just been like, the problem is like Men in Black International is so stuck in my brain. Like, that to me is just like so dreadful.
So filmmakers, if you want a good review from Tim Grierson, just make sure you release your movie, your kind of half-assed, kind of only really cares movie, the same week as a really truly horrible movie.
That's your only.
What came out the week of Warcraft?
Good question. I'm not going to be able to look that up, because dear God, it. Yeah.
All right. So what'd you give it?
I gave this a C.
I gave it a C minus. So far,
we're not that far off on this. Yeah, yeah. Right. Again, this movie is dumb and bad. And again, like, it's like just the transphobic joke. There's one that's more than enough, and it's just like, why? Why are we doing this? This is not a thing we need to be doing. And the thing is, like, it's not even Shaft who does the joke. It's somebody else in the movie who.
We're coming off a year where there was a transphobic joke in an Amy Poehler movie. Okay, so we're in like a weird.
Yes, it's been a tough summer. And by the way, I don't know how the FBI works, but I'm pretty sure that you don't just walk back in after being fired. No. Yeah, there have been so many movies this summer where people give rounds of applause for when other characters do things, so that we know, oh, they did a good job.
Yeah, it's cool.
With the thing that they did.
All right, so that's our show. Lots of movies. Sorry we went long, but we had lots of movies to discuss. Yeah. We have fewer movies to discuss next week, but we got one big one, as they say. The big movie coming out next week is Toy Story 4. You may remember Toy Story 4 from, well, the previous three Toy Story movies. You also remember it from our summer movie preview, in which Grierson and I had somewhat heated discussion about whether or not it was a good idea that they were even making this movie at all. So that will be a thick,
my argument was it was an abomination against God and nature. That I was like, don't do that. That would be... Yeah. It's not. The Bible says, "Thou shalt not make a fourth."
This is what will suck us into the Hellmouth. That's what this is going to do. That's, I think, the exact quote that you said. Yes. So, Toy Story 4, we'll be discussing that next week, directed by Josh Cooley, of course, starring the voices of all the people that you've gotten used to hearing, as well as Tony Hale, Jordan Peele, Keegan-Michael Key. Who else is that? Oh, and of course, Keanu Reeves. Keanu Reeves as a Duke Kaboom appears to be. His name, Toy Story 4. I feel like people will be discussing that movie. We're going to be a couple of them.
Yeah.
We have one.
Yes. Go ahead. Sorry, go ahead.
No, please.
No, please, go ahead.
Please. Let's go another 4 hours.
Yes.
Our second new movie and our final new movie next week is Child's Play. Child's Play is directed by Lars Klevberg. Where did I recognize that name? Have I heard that guy's name before? No?
I don't know your life, man. I don't know. The name did not ring a bell to me, but that doesn't mean anything.
Yeah. He's Norwegian. So, there he is. I guess that's probably why all my time in Norway. This is, of course, a reboot of the old 80s movie. This one with an interesting cast, I would say. Aubrey Plaza and Brian Tyree Henry. And, of course, this time, unlike in the original movies, because he presumably had better things to do back then, Mark Hamill does the voice of Chucky. Who's like a regular doll, except he stabs you.
That's different than a regular doll. What if Plaza had been the voice of Chucky?
and her Legion character. That'd be kind of interesting.
Yeah.
And we have one reboot movie next week, because there's only two big movies. That movie is 1990's The Hunt for Red October. Intrigued. Directed by John McTiernan. Starring Sean Connery. Trebek, Alec Baldwin, Scott Glenn, James Earl Jones, Sam Neill. Hunt for Red October. I haven't seen this movie in a really long time.
My dad is not effusive in his love of movies. This is a movie that if for any reason it comes up, he'll say, that's a really good movie. My dad, when it's on cable, he will watch it. But I haven't watched it in its entirety in a very long time.
I'd like to note that your father and my father are roughly the same age. Our parents, when this movie came out, were younger than we are right now. How do you feel about that, Grierson?
I don't say this very often, but I really hate you right now. All the crap you've said in this episode is redeemed by that blazing insight. That is fucking frightening, Will. That's really something. So thank you for reminding me of mortality and the shifting seasons of our lives.
Yep, exactly. Bingo. So next week we'll be discussing Toy Story 4, Child's Play, and The Hunt for Red October. Grierson, have a great week. I'm looking forward to discussing this, our Pixar movie, with you. I feel like there's going to be a lot to chew on. Grierson, have a great week. I will talk to you next week.
Bye.
Bye.
This shouldn't work, but it does. It only works 'cause of us. And should anyone say different, it wouldn't matter at all. This only works 'cause of us.